Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to the Frontier Beyond Fear radio program. I am your host, Susan Larison-Dans, and tonight we have a very special Saturday night broadcast with filmmaker Phil Lairness. And I'm really honored and delighted to have Phil on the show tonight. Phil is the director, co-executive producer, cinematographer, and editor of The Truth Is Out There, which is a very interesting documentary starring X-Files regular Dean Haglin, who is one of the lone gunmen on the X-Files, for those of you who may not watch the show. He is a very popular part of that show, although I know a lot of you do. Phil also co-hosts the Chill Pack Hollywood Hour weekly podcast with Dean. Phil is a graduate of the UCLA Film School, and has directed 6 feature films, more than 40 documentary short subjects, and several music videos and commercials. And he's currently working on a sequel to The Truth Is Out There, which is called The Truth Is Out There, Ancient Mysteries. And he's also developing a documentary called Hieroglyph of the Human Soul about the work of spiritual wayshower, artist, author, actor, and philosopher Lee McCloskey. Now, I want to say that Phil, beyond all of these accomplishments, is a very deep and insightful spiritual thinker. I first encountered Phil on a radio show in Portland, which is the Ground Zero radio program with Clyde Lewis. In fact, he had called in before coming to Portland for an event, and I got to see The Truth Is Out There, actually on 9/11. It's a film about conspiracy mixed with spirituality, and it's a fascinating exploration. And I actually got to talk with Phil on Clyde's show, and when I call into that show, I'm just Susan. It's really a nice opportunity to just call in and reflect on different topics. And I was impressed immediately with just how insightful Phil was, and I know that we're going to have a wonderful show tonight. We do have an open chat room tonight, and you are free to join that. In order to comment in the chat room, if you're new to Blog Talk Radio, you do have to get a login, but it's really easy to obtain, and then you can comment in the chat. We also have a call-in number for tonight's show, which is 310-807-5104. Now, before I bring Phil on, I'm going to play just a little piece on The Truth Is Out There so you can get a glimpse about what that's all about. So listen into this, and then we'll bring Phil on the show.
And now, hi, I am Dean Haglin here in the offices of Rational Exuberance.
Actually, that's the wrong piece. Ah, there we go. Here we go.
Of course, one of the big stars on The X-Files, and he's making a documentary called The Truth Is Out There.
One of the things that UFO research has done to me is instill in me a healthy disrespect for the things that government says.
They are poisoning our people. There is a population control agenda. There really are people who want to kill off the majority of the people in the world.
If we don't allow these corrupt banks to fail, then the nation will fail, and there will be no recovery.
Don't stand on the sides of the river and comment on how corrupt and dark and evil everything is. We all know that.
I don't need to have you understand or agree with me or believe. It doesn't matter to me. I know what I know.
The name of our film is?
The Truth Is Out There.
But it really isn't.
But isn't there a universal truth that science is going for?
Perhaps the universal truth is what makes us subject.
Okay, you just blew my mind.
And now, without further delay, I want to welcome Phil on the show. Hello, Phil.
Hello, Susan.
Seems your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour wanted to sneak in there a little bit in the beginning, but
and you didn't want it to. That's part of the conspiracy. What are you afraid to?
Oh well, you know, I have the plans that we lay. We'll give them a little glimpse of that a little bit later on the show.
It's, of course, an honor to be on any show called Frontier Beyond Fear. On the other hand, I got to tell you, your opening theme music scared the heck out of me. It's spooky.
Do you and really think so?
It is. It is. And that's okay, though. I mean, I joke. It is kind of spooky, though. And but that's all right, because, you know, so often we try to avoid fear, or we try to disown fear, or we try to ignore it altogether. And the truth is that fear, like everything, serves. The important thing is that you don't want to be used by your fear, and you don't want to meet your fear with fear of that fear. Like anything else, you want to take the fear and you want to move through it and form a relationship to it so that it becomes something that propels you upwards rather than something that holds you back.
Well, I'll tell you, Phil, I have had friends who have said to me that they are astonished that I have a program about fear, because quite honestly, especially when I was younger, I was an incredibly fear-based person. I came from a very fear-based background, religiously, you know, hellfire, the whole nine yards. And it had a real impact on me, too. Not to mention, I was just always afraid. You know, I was one of these people who was constantly thinking that, you know, you didn't do well in school or something wasn't going to go well. In fact, I often comment that I sometimes have been known to question the law of attraction and just how did I manage to get around it? Because I was a fear-based person. And so if anyone understands fear, I do. And for me, it's a moment-by-moment thing. And that's what I always say about this show, is that I know there are people out there like me that, in fact, we all are this way at times. And, you know, fear is with us often, and it's a matter of how we get through the moment. It's the moment that matters, and that's what I've really learned. And my life has really changed. I mean, when I've gone more deeply into my spiritual path, I have very much felt the impact of that. It's reflected. In fact, even doing this radio show, I mean, that alone, or calling into other shows like I do now, or even writing honestly, it all requires putting your fears at bay.
Fear is also one of those things that connect us as human beings uniquely, both as part of a collective. I mean, it's really interesting. The things that make us feel most alone are actually the things that connect us the most. And fear is one of them. And the reason for that is because fear, like pain, is something that you cannot compare. It's unique to every individual. You might tell me something you're afraid of, and I'll say, well, that's ridiculous. But you know what isn't ridiculous is to be afraid of clowns. Right? You know, I mean, we all have our unique thing, and that's true with pain, too, right? We all have different tolerances. We have different things that hurt us. And you know what else is that way? Is a sense of achievement. We're taught to believe that there are certain achievements that are really big deals, like scoring touchdowns or winning Oscars. But the truth is that no two people feel the same level of achievement about any particular thing. And I generally think that it's unique to whatever doubts you have. If something is difficult for you, if something's a real challenge and you learn something new in the process of overcoming that challenge, that feels like a real achievement. If it's something that you expect to do well at, then just because people are cheering for you doesn't necessarily mean that you'll think it was that much of an achievement because you expected it.
You know, that's so true, because we each have our own barriers that we're working through. We each have our own boundaries that we're expanding. And I kind of like this concept of a fear threshold, similar to a pain threshold. I think that's a really fascinating topic. And I think that just as we're sensitive to those that are in pain, when we can be sensitive to those that are in fear, and a lot of times we're not. You know, sometimes we don't cut people in fear a lot of slack. Like if we're, sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. But we really need to be mindful of that, because what we're getting at is the real vulnerability of the human soul. I mean, that's where we're connecting at that level. When we can be vulnerable and express our fears,
absolutely,
that's when we connect at the deepest level.
I always say that intimacy is our birthright, and it's one of the true parts of life that there will never be too much of. There is always a shortage of genuine intimacy with the people in our lives, and it's one of the real reasons I was inspired to make The Truth Is Out There. I think this lack of sensitivity to other people's fear is just another reason we don't listen to anyone, and I think it probably gets back at our own fear, really, because look, why would we not be willing to listen to someone when they're expressing their fear? Maybe because we're scared that we'll be taken by their fear. Maybe we're scared that we'll end up giving our power over to their fear. And this is nowhere is this more true, let's face it, than in conspiracy theories. But what I found when Dean and I were traveling around interviewing people and hearing their theories and hearing the really dark places some of these people's theories would lead them, where some of, and I keep saying theories, I mean, it's not like, you know, these people aren't doing research and aren't digging, you know, but there's so much darkness around us all the time, it seems. And sometimes when people research a particular topic that really, you know, energizes them, it ends up leading them into greater darkness, into greater fear, because what they discover makes them feel even more powerless than they did at the beginning of that journey. And what I found when Dean and I traveled around listening to people was we would find people like this. We would find people who truly had succumbed, had gone down the rabbit hole of fear. The most amazing thing was, though, that by the end of the conversation with them, they had discovered a certain level of hope. Mm-hmm. One person might be saying, like Dr. Stanley Monteith did in our interview with him, he said it's not a question of if or it's just a question of when and how soon the war is coming. And by the end of the interview, he said he felt more hopeful than he ever had about the future of humanity. And I've got to believe that part of that hope came from the fact that there were simply two other people sitting there in that room listening to him and appreciating him, not just for the information that he had to offer, but for his personal story and his journey that led him to that information. Just the act of listening to someone can really open up new possibilities for people.
And, you know, there's so many people who don't want to listen to these kinds of things. And I feel
I'm going
like...
to cut you off right there. See what I did?
Hey,
see what I did there?
They need to. But, you know, one of the things I will say about your film and about your work, and this is so true in life in general, is how humor and laughter disarm fear. I mean, we've always known this, and yet you've been able to deploy that very effectively, you and Dean. And to me, humor is a wonderful weapon against fear. You know, they say that love is a weapon, if you want to call it a weapon. It is an antidote to fear, let's put it that way. But you know what? Laughter, it's really important. And, you know, sometimes when we're caught in fear-based situations, there's nothing like laughing through it. I'll tell you a quick story. Years ago, I was in a car accident, and I had to go through this really frightening test where they would shock you. They'd actually put needles in you and shock you to test your nerves. And I laughed through the test, Phil. I laughed through the test. I don't know how I knew to do that. And they probably thought I was crazy.
Well,
but you know what? It worked. And it was as if sometimes I feel like in my life a higher thing has taken over and said, laugh. Or, you know, when I was giving birth, I didn't laugh when I was giving birth, but I had sort of a higher experience taking over then. But how laughter disarmed not only fear but pain in that situation.
Absolutely. I think, you know, what you said at the outset that, you know, we like to think that love is the antidote to fear. The truth is that love, more than anything else, probably leads us into fear because it makes us vulnerable. We get so scared about not being lovable or not loving enough or having love taken away from us. I mean, love will lead us to vulnerability, and it has to, because you have to go through vulnerability to achieve real intimacy, intimacy with yourself, intimacy with others, intimacy with all the good, the bad, and the ugly that make up this experience we call life. Humor is something that really can counteract fear, even in moments of vulnerability, especially in moments of vulnerability. The caution is you don't want to be using it as a defense, or else it's probably going to stand in the way of greater communication, stand in the way of greater vulnerability. It's fascinating to me. I got my sense of humor from my father. And not to throw my father under the bus, but you know what, he's not listening, so we can go ahead and talk about him. He has tended to always use, he's a salesman since way back, and so humor became a wonderful tool for him in order to sell his products and things. At the same time, though, it became such old hat for him. Like any of our greatest strengths, it can also become our greatest weakness. And sure enough, humor became the thing he goes to so easily that it tends to prevent communication. And growing up seeing that and feeling that, I always wanted to at least try to make sure that humor was something that I was using to inspire communication. And having traveled the world with Dean Haglund, who of course is a trained improv comic, one of the things that I witnessed in him, and one of the things that was told to us by women like Marilyn Schlitz, who runs the Institute of Noetic Sciences, like men like Bill Tiller, the noted physicist, so many people, we were told that humor is the most important skill set for survival in the 21st century, because humor is what allows us to immediately look at something from a different perspective, to turn something on its side and to look at it a different way. That's what humor is all about. And when we can do that, we immediately step out of the shoes we were in before, we take on a slightly different perspective, and sometimes we take a perspective that looks a little bit more like the person we're talking to. And it also prevents us from taking ourselves too seriously. I think I am someone, and I know that the people I most admire are this way, and that is they take their work very seriously, but they never take themselves too seriously.
And actually, that's important, really, because that's how you're able to do what you do. If you took yourself too seriously, you probably wouldn't be able to accomplish things at the level that you're managing to do so. And that's what I love about both you and Dean. I mean, you come across, you're so approachable. I mean, that's what it is. It's, you know, I think that the lesson so many of us need to learn is that the more people you meet, and I've met a lot of really interesting people in the spiritual world and in, you know, the business world, all over, you know, everybody is a human being. I mean, no matter what their achievements are, and, you know, there are a lot of people who figured it out and they don't take themselves too seriously, even though they have a really high level of accomplishment, and it makes them approachable. It allows you to connect in that intimate way, Phil, with your audiences.
One of the real inspirations, one of the real reasons we made The Truth Is Out There, if we could accomplish nothing else, and I think we did make a film that accomplishes quite a few rather remarkable things, but if we had done nothing else other than make a movie that showed that turning off the internet or turning off 24-hour news or getting out of our comfort zone and going out into the world to meet people and to learn about how they see the world and how they see things and learning about them and learning how they see the world, that this is fun. This is always fun, especially if those people are people you might disagree with. It's fun. We seem to have lost sight of the fact that that kind of human interaction with people who see things differently than us is the joy of being alive. It's not the bane of our existences. And so seeking the truth is fun. It ought to be fun. Of course, it's tiring. There comes with a price, but it is it certainly is fun. And I appreciate what you said about us both being approachable. I'm not sure I am, really, to be honest with you. Dean and I sort of seem like one fully functional human being, to be honest with you, which is why we're good business partners and producing partners, because he is very friendly. Uh-huh. I would not say that my default position is friendly. Sometimes when I walk through the world, I tend to wear armor on me, I can get overwhelmed by crowds. I can, so I'm not, it isn't second nature for me to enter into the world as a quote-unquote friendly person. However, there is a distinction between being friendly and being kind. I don't mean to be rude. I'm not trying to push people away. It's just that I'm not necessarily inviting them in. When people do get over whatever energy I'm sending out, be it intimidating or scary or whatever, I've heard these things. Mm-hmm. When they come up and talk to me, they do find, lo and behold, I'm kind and I'm gentle and I'm generous. And I think that's an important thing, because we do need to overcome our fear and approach people who might not seem necessarily friendly, but nevertheless are lovely people. Because after all, friendliness only goes so far. What we really want are people who are kind and generous. And I liken the difference to the old adage about Los Angeles versus New York. I mean, I think there's this perception that people in Los Angeles are so friendly and kind, and people in New York are so cold and brusque. And the truth is, having lived in Los Angeles almost all my life now, yes, people in Los Angeles are really friendly, but that's because we all know that the world revolves around us, so it's easy to be friendly. Whereas in New York, people are just really busy. And yet what's astonishing is if you come up out of a subway and you stop for a moment to look at a map, you will have 5, 6, 7 people in succession quickly ask you, do you need directions somewhere? Do you need directions? Can I help you? They won't break stride while doing it because they're in a hurry to get somewhere, but they do have an actual concern for you. Yeah. In Los Angeles, we're willing to smile and wave at you. I'm not sure we have the same concern for helping you, though.
You know, something I've observed, and I'll tell you that
great.
My family...
I've just offended everyone who's listening.
Yeah,
to
probably. I was going to say, my family is from the New York area, and something I've observed, and I'm not. I'm actually from Colorado, but the rest of my family is from that area. And what I've observed is that even though there can be this perceived edge out there, and no doubt people can be very expressive on the East Coast if something isn't going their way or whatever, it's the level of communication. They will engage. You know, they'll engage. I would watch, my father, for example, who passed away earlier this year. He was the most social person, and he would engage anyone in a conversation. You know, he'd be in the line for whatever. And I always viewed that as very Eastern, whereas in some other parts of the country, and I kind of inherited that too, where, it's not just idle small talk. I mean, I don't know. It's hard to explain the difference. And maybe you know what I'm talking about, is that they engage in conversation when there's an opportunity.
In
Los
Angeles,
you don't always see that everywhere.
In Los Angeles, we're very separated. We're separated by great distances. We're separated by being in our cars alone most of the day, and it's quite a different way of living. It's also, ironically, the reason why Los Angeles is such a better networking city than New York, because of the simple fact that in Los Angeles, it is so hard to actually meet someone and maintain a closeness with them because of the isolation, because of the distance, that when you do meet someone with whom you have great rapport and a rapport that you wish to explore and deepen and nurture, you really make the effort to do so. In New York, I can't tell you how many times where I've been in a party and I meet someone who's fascinating, and then I get out of that crowded party to the door and I think it's time to leave. Should I go back and get that person's contact information? And then I say, oh, well, never mind. I'm going to meet someone interesting right out on the street now in a minute anyway. because you're constantly meeting people. So it's really one of these things where I feel like in New York you take it for granted, in other cities you take it for granted. In Los Angeles, you really have to work to maintain that kind of connection, and therefore you do, and therefore important networking happens.
Now, I know you've been traveling the world with your film, The Truth Is Out There, and I'm curious, what has been the response overseas to your film? Didn't you just go to something in England not too long ago, if I recall? How are they receiving this film? What is the response?
It's interesting. When we were first making the film, when we were shooting it and traveling around, there was a lot of concern in Europe about these issues of conspiracy theories, because really for the first time they were finding themselves sort of having these stories emerge in their own countries, in their own cultures. And so they were looking to Dean and myself as some sort of experts on how they could handle what was really fresh snow for them to trod in. And so that was one unique difference. In showing the film, you know, we did have the world premiere of the film in London in May of 2011. And I went back a year later to show the film several times throughout the UK in May of this year. And there was one particular event that I think you know about, where it was at Goldsmiths College, which is part of the University of London. And it was for the School of Psychology, and it was something called The Psychology of Belief. And we had the screening of the film. And I was rather astonished, because I had about a third of the audience really angry with me after seeing the film.
Yeah.
About a third of the audience wanted to do battle with those people on my behalf. And of course I would not let them, because the whole point of the film is that everybody should feel free to express themselves and to communicate. And I was telling Clyde about this the other night on Ground Zero. You know, I mean,
yeah.
I've been around long enough to know that the bigger someone's reaction, the older the material they're dealing with. So if seeing a movie causes people in the audience to be yelling at me, clearly it has very little to do with me, and it has to do with something pretty deep in their psyche for them to have such a big reaction. So the least I can do is sit there and listen. And what came through again and again was this belief on their part that it was dangerous for me to have given voice to theories and information that I knew to be wrong. They first of all assumed that I knew certain things to be wrong. They also assumed that what was being said was wrong. But even if those were true, and I'm not going to say one way or another if I believe that they are right in those assumptions, but even if those were true, their belief that somehow it was my responsibility as a filmmaker to tell people they're wrong was sort of astonishing to me. I was making a documentary, and the documentary I was making was not a film about me traveling the world telling people they're wrong.
Yes. Uh-huh.
It's me traveling the world with Dean Haglund, listening to the stories they have to tell, and seeing if it is possible for us to take what is unique and insightful and beautiful about what everyone has to offer and create something beautiful out of it. That's my responsibility as a storyteller. And oh, by the way, that is my responsibility as a human being, to walk through the world and to build a life that is meaningful and hopefully artful through everything that I am offered by all the souls I encounter. And ultimately, I did the best I could to try to explain to this audience that that's where I stand for personal responsibility, for being the best person I can be, and for being of service as best that I am capable of being. And that's not going to look like any other filmmaker. It's not going to look like any other person, of course.
Yeah, you know, I have to say that one of the reasons that I started getting active in not only this show and writing and different things was also to allow certain stories to be told that often aren't told. You know, we all come from these unique perspectives. And, you know, I feel that one area, in fact, some of the people, they laugh about who I am having come out of this evangelical community, for example. That is a huge part of our culture in the United States, although we don't really acknowledge it. And a lot of people have either come out of it or are in it. And, you know, for me, the challenge in navigating these waters is reflecting on my own personal truths, my own personal discoveries, which can be brutally, brutally honest, while still allowing that culture to be and recognizing that it exists. And so there are all these stories in the world. And, you know, I'll bring people even on this show that may be talking about something that I don't totally buy into or agree with, and yet we have a conversation. I mean, that's the purpose, because I, too, want to hear the story. But for me, the challenge, and I'm not in exactly your place, because I do interject in my work, my personal viewpoints, but more about, you know, keeping it focused on, well, this is my journey, you know, and that's a whole different way of navigating through things. Whereas in your case, you don't tell your story. You are an objective filmmaker. Although Dean, as he's talking to these people in the film, you can certainly see it reflected through his eyes of discovery, reflected through who Dean Haglin is. I don't think he's faking that at all. I think he really is Dean responding to all these people. And that reflects the story, too. And as you do that, you're telling the story of who Dean is, too, which I think really adds to the film.
It's wrong, though, to think that I'm objective. I mean, I don't even know what that means. I mean, I see the world through my prism. I'm not capable of doing anything other
than
seeing the world. Exactly. So.
But you're a storyteller is what you're saying.
So it's to try to bring my subjectivity to bear in as grounded an objectivity as possible.
Right. Okay.
In editing the film and having all these hundreds of hours of footage and really trying to accomplish something that I'd never seen in any movie before, which was to create a truly spherical structure, which expresses kind of this idea of the emerging of a spherical consciousness that I think is going on with humanity right now, and to make a film where it's not linear, it's not circular, where you can enter the film at any point you want, you can watch it as many times as you want, and it's up to the viewer to draw connections between different things that are said and echoed between one half of the film and another, almost like making new synapses in your own brain. And so to have something like this, to hold this spherical image that scintillates and resonates, and yet at the same time provides enough of a map for people so that they don't feel lost, was a huge challenge. And it was never fun to make this. I went into the editing room every day into that deep pit of darkness of being in over my head and not knowing how to do this because I'd never done anything like that before. And what I would find every single day was that simply by listening to the people we interviewed, I would get my cues on how to edit the film. And what emerged was I realized I wasn't so much an editor, I wasn't so much a filmmaker, as I was the host at the coolest dinner party I've ever been to. That was my role. And what does a good host do? A good host makes his guests feel welcome. And how do you make someone feel welcome? By making them feel seen and heard. That was my job. And so it was really interesting then to look at that, to see the film and to see, yes, this is about Dean Haglin. The law of attraction dictates that all of these people we interviewed must be reflecting parts of Dean, or he would not be there and they would not be there. Mm-hmm. At the same time, though, when I was alone in the editing room, oh, that means all of these pieces must reflect parts of me, or I would not be the one here editing these conversations.
Wow,
we don't always get what we want. We do always get what we are. And that was a rather astonishing and profound realization in the editing of The Truth Is Out There.
And that's so often true when you're talking to someone. Sometimes I have had so many experiences where another person mirrors who I am right back at me, even especially when it's an uncomfortable situation. You know, it's just mirrored right back. And then you really can come to terms with that, I think.
Well, and, you know, and this is why, then again, to listen and not need any members of that audience at Goldsmiths College to take, quote-unquote, my part and argue with the other people who are yelling at me, it truly, there's something in this exchange that I am meant to be participating in because I have attracted this. And so when I'm asked the question, And the professor that hosted it, the wonderful Chris French, who's just a wonderful man, he asked me in front of everyone, isn't it dangerous, though, to at times to give voice to certain ideas? And I could not be so presumptuous to say that it's never dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Hate speech, for example, can incite horrible things. What we do know in this country, though, and what I know from my own personal experience, is what is always dangerous is trying to suppress expression. That's
yes.
always dangerous. Now, might it still be dangerous sometimes to allow it? Of course. The only way we can form a relationship to what people are really thinking and feeling, though, is if they express what they're thinking and feeling. If we ever want to achieve a society where we do practice what the Buddhists call right speech, where what we have to express is only expressed when we know it's kind, necessary, and true, and improves upon the silence, the only way we're ever going to get there, the only way I'm ever going to get there as a person, is if I practice communication, if I
mm-hmm.
express myself. And that was a unique thing for me to take away from that screening, was to realize that other parts of the world have freedom. What is it? We have 207 sovereign nations in this world, 180
mm-hmm.
enjoy freedom. Our relationship to this concept of freedom of speech, though, is a unique relationship. It has lasted longer and been more hard fought than in any other country I can think of. And so it is interesting to travel and get that question. And indeed, afterwards, in the aftermath of that screening, I went out, as I do, because I'm so personable, I went out drinking with many of the people who most were in my face during the screening and continued the conversation afterwards and had a great time and truly made friends with several of these people. But one of the things that made me laugh, because I'll get this in arguments again and again, is people will say, okay, I appreciate what you're saying. I appreciate, you know, you're a lovely person, and that's a great philosophy. Still, there has to be times when we've got to seek to silence and stifle expression. Take, for example, and inside I'm doing the countdown because I know what the example is going to be. Let's take, for example, we'll start with Hitler.
That's always the example.
And it's always the example they start with. And I love when they say, we'll start with Hitler. Whoa,
yeah, actually,
I can't wait to hear where you go when
it ends there.
Yeah, where does it go when it gets really bad? But, you know, again, in this country, we've seen of late in with so many topics, you know, hate gets expressed. And there is this immediate response to want to shame or to silence the expression of hate. And
mm-hmm.
One expression of this that's really illustrative to me was when the former professional basketball player Don Ameche came out as being gay. And interviewers went to number of current and former NBA players to get their reaction. And Tim Hardaway, a former All-Star guard in the NBA, who had actually been my favorite player when he was playing, he let loose a commentary that was justly characterized as hurtful and very anti-gay. And when talking about this, Don Ameche actually said, what Tim Hardaway expressed was not the problem. It's the problem is all the people who feel the exact same way, but silence it out of some sort of false sense of political correctness.
You know, I've heard that said before, that in a way, by, and there's a balance here. This is a really difficult, challenging territory to maneuver.
Absolutely.
But boy, there is a balance, because, you know, you see it. You know where you see it? Like in the anonymous comments. You go to Yahoo or any place and you read those comments that people are posting, and sometimes they can just be amazing. And I don't think they're all just trolls. You know, there's this concept of the troll. I think there are really people out there who believe some of these things. And if we're in denial that that exists because we don't want to hear it, and yet how do we hear it is the question. But then we don't know what our society is composed of. Then we don't really know what the true nature of what people are thinking about, what it
and
is.
And they might not even truly feel that way or think that way.
Well,
they might be taken.
Yeah.
They might be taken by an impulse that leads them to believe that. Any
it
of us who have been in relationships, be it with a romantic partners or business partners or parents, all of us have experience saying things as if we mean it, and then as soon as we've said it, realizing, I just said something I don't really mean, and regretting the words that have come out of our mouth. All of us get taken by anger. All of us get taken by fear. And unfortunately, we speak in those moments.
Mm-hmm.
And so it gets back to this issue to me that we can't allow anything to become disowned. When it becomes disowned, that's when it becomes dangerous. When we disown something because, oh, it's not politically correct to think that way, or we disown something because, oh, people might judge me for thinking this way or for feeling this way or for being this way, when we disown it for all those reasons, it only is going to become more powerful and suddenly become dangerous. When we feed the snake is not dangerous. When we starve the snake becomes very dangerous. And that's why I think it's important within ourselves to appreciate all the voices that are coming forward. Maybe if we recognized that we have many voices inside us at any given time. We have many competing impulses of things we would like to say or things we would like to express. And if we realized we have multiples of these and we simply listened first to what we want to say without identifying with what we want to say, then maybe, just maybe, we'll be patient enough to allow the right message to come forward, the one that resonates with us the most. When I first spoke to you on Clyde's show on Ground Zero, and I remember
mm-hmm.
quite clearly, how could I not?
Mm-hmm.
It was about 2:30 in the morning where I was on the East Coast in the middle of a blackout. And so I was sitting in the dark talking about issues like 9/11, and because, of course, the 10th anniversary of 9/11 was coming
right
up. And I got a rather distasteful message from the producer of The Truth Is Out There before going on that show and doing other interviews of that kind that week about the anniversary of 9/11. And the message that he had for me was a warning that I better not talk about 9/11 like I knew what had happened, because I don't know what happened and I'm liable to offend people and to make them angry and all this. And his message served to, of course, make me angry, and yet it did serve. And ultimately, I'm grateful for that message, because I looked at what about it really made me angry, and what made me angry was this idea that I didn't know what happened.
Uh-huh.
And so I looked at, okay, do I know what happened? And what is that I know that happened? And so I started looking at what I really knew beyond what I believed, because so much of what we debate and argue about in this society is based on what we believe. If we could at least respect each other enough to listen to each other's beliefs, to listen to them, to try to understand them, then we might get to that wonderful conversation that transcends belief and gets to what we know. And what I realized I knew about what happened on 9/11 was I knew that my best friend's daughter was born while those towers were falling on television in the delivery room.
Yeah.
What I knew was that was the day that my dear friend Lee McCloskey, about whom we'll speak some more, fell upon his knees and realized that the only response to an act of destruction has to be an act of creation. And so he began a journey that has no precedence in the world of art and philosophy, to my eyes and in my heart. And 9/11, 2001 was the day that I realized that I had better dedicate myself to telling stories that need to be told, that are about ideas that enrich us and nourish us, rather than enslaving us with some sort of false concept of right and wrong. And so I do know that all those things happened on 9/11, and so I would say that I actually have a pretty good understanding of what took place that day.
You know, I have to say that when I think about, you know, I was in Kansas when 9/11 happened, and I was basically playing the role as you know, traditional wife, mother. I worked a little bit at the time, and I was in a very conservative place at that time. And, you know, I don't know that I actually put two and two together until maybe even today when I was looking at some information on Lee McCloskey and the documentary that you're creating on him. And I got to thinking, you know, I awakened in the year after that. And isn't that interesting? I mean, it was in that time after that, and I really feel that probably was a trigger for a lot of people. I did not exist as this person you're talking to right now. I was actually in denial of my spirituality at that time. There is no way I would have dreamed of, let alone having a spiritual radio show or writing about spiritual topics. I wouldn't have even thought to do that back then. And yet, I really think what 9/11 did for a lot of people is it brought them face-to-face with fear. In the Midwest, there was a lot of fear, and I remember that very, very vividly. And I have to feel that there are a lot of people, if we could do a study, like what happened to you in the 2 years after 9/11, that would be a really interesting question, because I have a feeling that it was a trigger for a lot of us. And it was only after that, and I think it drove my own fears to their limits, you know, the anxiety. And, you know, people forget about the scares that happened even after that whole year, that whole period, wondering if the mail was contaminated. I remember that one. You know, there were people genuinely concerned about that after in that time frame. And all kinds of stuff was going on back then. And I just think it caused people to come face to face with their fear, and I'd love to know what other things were created out of that period, because I have a feeling it's a more common experience than we realize. It was kind of like, I remember at the time thinking of it, we all, and I heard it on the news, we've all just gotten a diagnosis of cancer. You know, even if they were not telling us all the truth, and honestly, I really don't know. I try to transcend beyond whatever that is, and I know that's something we want to get at on this show too, is you know, how do you transcend beyond all the frightening things that come out? No matter who did it, it's frightening, quite honestly.
Right.
And,
well,
and you have to transcend it.
I'm not sure that it was getting a diagnosis of cancer. I almost feel like it was, well, maybe we got the diagnosis, but that was also the tumor being removed. I am struck by how many people, you know, have been interviewed that were supposed to be in the towers and weren't there, didn't go that day.
Yeah.
Many people who work in the towers, and they just said, you know what, I got up in that morning and I just could not face another day of going into a job that I hated. I felt like I would die if I went in there one more day. And you know, one of these people is in our film, The Truth Is Out There, Gemma Bulos. She was supposed to be in the towers that day, and she decided just she didn't want to. And in the aftermath after it, she looked around, and as so many people were frightened that the world was falling apart, what she saw in all these people helping each other was the world coming together. And so it's what motivated her to dedicate herself towards bringing clean drinking water to people in the third world. I mean, there are so many stories, like you're saying, that we could find. And to me, you know, I've been really critical of our quote-unquote elected leaders in the wake of, especially in the wake of 9/11. And again, beyond the issue of who did what to whom that day, we all remember what an incredible marshaling of positive energy, of hopeful healing energy and goodwill the people not only in this country but around the world had. If a true leader had stepped up and said, we are going to respond to this attack by becoming the best fed, the best educated, the healthiest people on the planet, can you imagine how we would have transformed this country in the 10 years since? Instead, of course, our marching orders were to go to war and to go shopping. So there was this incredible failure of leadership. There was this incredible failure on the part of what I will call the mainstream media, though that's become such a cliche itself. But there was such a failing on the part of the media to create a conversation that had genuine meaning to it in the wake of 9/11. And I have been critical of those failures, and yet at the same time, I am someone who fundamentally believes everything serves. That is not to say that it makes everything okay. Those are not the same things, but it does serve. And one of the ways those failings served was to teach people like you and people like me and people like Clyde and people like I described who are in The Truth Is Out There and countless people, inspired them to realize if the cultural conversation is not nourishing, then maybe we had better start our own. And so many of us have been inspired to do just that.
You know what's so interesting? As you're talking about this, I'm realizing there were many facets of that experience, and that I experienced it, Phil, through the eyes of the Midwest. And although I did have some awareness of the world coming together, I did. What I saw there was more a reactionary response. And it's sort of what fueled it. It was the kind of thing that I think was leveraged when we went to war. I mean, where they were able to use that, use those kinds of fears to allow that to occur. You know, we could have responded in a much different way. We could have responded in an entirely different way because the world had shifted in a sense in that moment. It's like we jumped ahead. I love to think, when I think about the support that was out there in the world, which I had some awareness of, I did, it's as if it's a glimpse of the shift that I think is really going to occur. It's as if we jumped ahead for a moment, multidimensionally. And it felt our togetherness, but then descended into fear in certain parts of the country anyway.
And it's interesting how, you know, this concept comes forward in making a movie about conspiracy. And I keep saying it's about conspiracy, but as we've also discussed, it's every bit as much about comedy. It's every bit as much about consciousness. But in talking about conspiracy, so often the conspiracy theory itself almost becomes the conspiracy because it can be used to divide people. So you still have so much intense argumentation, arguing over what took place on 9/11, who did what to whom, who was behind the attacks, what really happened, what brought those buildings down. You have so many. And as Clyde and I were talking about at that anniversary event and before it, to a degree, those conversations are almost irrelevant. I mean, they are relevant from a criminal justice point of view. We can agree a crime was done, and you want criminals to be brought to justice. Of course, we never really investigated it like a crime scene. So that would be one question. But I'm not a police officer. I'm not a district attorney. And what I'm interested in are more fundamental questions that might be able to bring people together, because they might be questions that we can embody as people. And once, if we could get past the argument over it, I think a great many of us could get behind questions like, is it ever okay to respond to an act of violence with violence? Under what circumstances is that okay? Because after all, we're letting violence win. And beyond
yes.
that, even if you're okay with the question, with the idea of going to war, how can we be confident with the reasons we are given to go to war when powerful international corporations stand to gain to the tune of billions and trillions of dollars over the death and destruction that that war will create? As long as there is such an incredible profit motive, how can we ever trust the reasons that we're given?
Well, see, there's the problem, isn't it? I mean, with the military-industrial complex, as we know, you know, Eisenhower warned us against it, and I feel very strongly, I think our economy would collapse without it. There are so
of
many
course.
Jobs within that entire zone. I mean,
sure.
And
it's
so that's always been a problem that we've had.
Well,
not
always.
But it is a modern problem. Let's
exactly.
just put it that way.
Cold War.
Yes.
Post Cold War. I mean, you know, it wasn't that long ago. It was World War II, remember, when Howard Hughes, one of the richest, most powerful men in the world, was brought on charges before Congress as being a war profiteer. He was charged with making money on the war.
Shocking. Wow.
Can you imagine there was a time when the rich and powerful were brought on charges for making money?
Yeah.
And now it's considered American to make money off war.
It's part of the profit motive. Yeah. I mean, that really does bother me. I mean, there is no question. I have to tell you, and you know, kind of getting back to something that was a fundamental notion of what I wanted to talk with you about tonight is that, you know, there are several industrial complexes in place. I mean, you've got the military industrial area, you've got the medical area, which to me is also very corrupt, the whole insurance industry, and even, you know, how cures, I believe, are suppressed and things like that, you know, then that they're managing things that maybe they, you know, to facilitate profit. That makes people really uncomfortable to explore.
Absolutely.
And then the prison industrial complex. That's yet another one.
Well, I was motivated in part to do Truth Is Out There because of the healthcare debate in this country,
mm-hmm.
where
mm-hmm.
I just got so frustrated. I tend to make movies now about things that make me angry, and I try to see if I can find out how they serve, and I try to see if I can find out how they're funny, and because at least I will be a more enjoyable person to be around,
uh-huh.
if not a more interesting filmmaker. And I was so frustrated with the healthcare debate because I saw it just devolve into competing conspiracy theories. And again, the conspiracy theories were used against each other to keep people from asking, I thought, the really valuable questions. And to me, some of those questions involved, you know, what do we expect from a healthcare system? What do we mean by healthcare? What do we mean by health? Why is it called healthcare and never health cure? What role does nutrition
mm-hmm.
play? What role does the corporatization of our food supply, of pharmaceuticals, of insurance? You know, and instead we had debates over socialism and birth certificates, and you know we're not a healthier people. We have no more of a sense of what will allow us to be healthy. It's really, again, a missed opportunity to have a public discussion, but that was never the aim to begin with. And you mentioned that we're doing a sequel to The Truth Is Out There. We're actually traveling around shooting for two sequels to it. One is called Truth Is Out There, Ancient Mysteries, which is about how we can explore mysteries of the past, ask questions about how does knowledge get lost from generation to generation, from era to era, and how does losing that information perhaps serve us so that we can remember it, we can rediscover it, and how can we, in exploring those ancient mysteries, learn to ask better questions moving forward into what seems to be such a frightening future.
Yeah.
At the same time, we're shooting another sequel called The Truth Is Out There, Business as Usual. And this derives from a conversation that takes place in Truth Is Out There when journalist Mark Bennett expressed his belief that there is no such thing as conspiracy. They're simply business as usual. That if you really look at how industries do business, they're not keeping their methodology secret from anyone. It might be inhuman. It might be amoral. It might be shocking and disgusting. It's like the old adage, you don't want to know how the sausage gets made.
Uh-huh.
But they're not keeping it secret. It's just how they do business, and it's not personal. Now, I know, counter to that, we have people in the movie saying that all of business is a conspiracy, and those are kind of two sides to the same coin, or you know, the same side to two different
yeah.
coins. But I am interested in that idea of how these businesses, these industries operate, and I've started shooting interviews about another one that I hadn't given a lot of thought to. We all watched with horror for 4 years as the housing industry and the subprime mortgage scandal captured the headlines. The truth is it's still going on. The housing industry is just about the most corrupt industry you could possibly find. The loan sharks have more ethics than
yes.
the banking industry. And for starters, the housing industry is $70 trillion in debt, supposedly. $70 trillion. And yet, the total amount of loans they've given out is $17 trillion. That's bad math.
Definitely.
And so here's another one of those industries for you. And so we are exploring all these things in two sequels.
You know, I like that concept of business as usual because that is kind of the way. Isn't it true that when you're on a certain path, so many people don't even acknowledge that this is wrong? You know, they so embrace, and you know, I know that right and wrong are very subjective. There is no question about it. But I think in the business world that people get so accustomed to business as usual, and of course
Absolutely.
The profit motive is paramount, and they have to please the stockholders, that's paramount, and you know, they'll suppress all kinds of things. I mean, look what happened over at the Penn State thing with Sandusky. I mean, that's business as usual, and that's really, that's getting exposed in a really nasty way now. I mean, because they had their eye on profit and how it would impact them. How is it going to impact the school and all that? And yet people got seriously hurt. Children got hurt.
There are still people that are apologizing for Joe Paterno. There are still people
yes.
who are apologizing for him. What I could not believe that I heard last night when it came out, all that he knew and when he knew it,
uh-huh.
that there are still people apologizing and saying, oh, it's such a shame that his legacy has to be tarnished by this. Tarnished by, this is his legacy. Football
Unfortunately.
Wins, football wins are, a,
yes.
are an asterisk. You know what he was? He was supposed to be an educator who was in charge of young men. That's
yes.
his job. And what a shock that there would be a scandal in an entire industry that is about exploiting young people for profit.
It's truly shocking. And
I mean, until we realize that college athletics is all about exploiting young people,
yes, it is.
Until we realize that, we're going to keep
truly
being shocked
is.
By these scandals. And in my own personal life, this idea of business as usual was what kind of led to me going into business with Dean. We had worked together on a feature film, and we had written another feature film, and we were doing our podcast together. But I was working as managing director for a consortium of Europe-based film distribution companies. And
uh-huh.
as the credit collapse approached in 2008, I saw the writing on the wall that the world credit system was really in trouble, and that was going to devastate the way the film industry did business. And I had been researching so many better ways of doing business in film distribution, and I would go to my own employers, I would go to the executives at other companies, and I would show them my research and show them my theories. And people would say to me, Phil, you're a very smart man, but this is not how we do business. This is not the way business is done.
Uh-huh.
So I walked away, and I quit my job. And people said to me, oh, my goodness, if you're right and this credit collapse is coming, and I said, oh, I'm right, then aren't you scared to quit your job now with economic upheaval coming? And I said to them, well, if I keep my job out of fear of what's going to happen, then fear is always going to be a part of my job.
That's true.
And I also was armed with the knowledge that in crisis, in chaos, if you are smart, have good ideas, and keep a clear head, people will listen to you. So a year after I first started showing people my ideas, I went back to those who were still in business, and I told them these ideas again. And it truly was as if they were hearing it for the first time. And they would express to me enthusiastically, these are great ideas. And then suddenly, with all the walls coming down all around them, they would stop themselves and say, but wait a minute, if this is a good idea, why hasn't anyone done this before?
Huh.
And I threw up my hands going, well, that's because I tried to tell you and you said, oh, that's how business is done. So I finally just said, you know what, Dean, you and I are going to prove this on our own. So we decided to make The Truth Is Out There and distribute it ourselves and show that some of the methodologies I had in mind could work in that way.
You know, I'm beginning to think more and more people are independently coming to these conclusions and walking away. You know, I have to tell you, part of my story, without getting into it too deeply, I was in the corporate world for years and actually got to the point where I was working on the executive floor. And I had a job that we had essentially created to facilitate communications between the executives and the engineers, because it was an engineering company. And I had the most, I had this plan that I laid out that was really detailed, and people responded to it. Some people just loved it. But in the end, it was, you know, it didn't really correspond to business as usual. And so I went through the same thing. And, you know, then there was no funding for this. Of course, then, you know, I burnt bridges that I shouldn't have burnt. I was very naive working up there. I mean, I didn't quite understand what's involved when you get to that level. I think a lot of people don't understand, and you have to be very mindful. And I actually cared about what I wanted to do and very passionately, and that's not necessarily a good thing. Not in those kinds of jobs. I mean, and you know, it's funny. And so I watched that collapse. I could have stayed in another job. Actually, we tried to move my job somewhere to a little less. It wouldn't have been as visible, but it still would have been able to do some things that were important. But there was no money. I mean, the economy was going down. And I had another option there. I could have stayed. I actually had a friend who basically created a job for me. But you know what? I walked away too, Phil. I walked away. And it was the bravest thing I ever did, and I don't think I even knew how brave until some years later. You know, this was, 3 years ago or something? You know, just as things were collapsing. And you know, it does take courage to navigate through the business world. And I'll tell you, I cannot succumb to lower impulses within business. And I'm seeing this within the enlightened business community. And I'm watching, and here we get into some spiritual things. I tell you, Phil, do you see these synchronistic things that just happen? Like one of the ways we met, I ended up becoming the social media person for the Conscious Life Expo, which is a pretty big event, you know, that connects me to some really cool people. And it just happened through synchronicity and trust and not doing things conventionally at all. Actually, I've been told so many times, you're doing it wrong. You know, you're doing it wrong.
Right.
And how many of us are like this? I keep running into people who are like this, who we're all doing it wrong, and yet somehow I think we're beginning to do it right. What do you think?
Well, there's this belief, I think, that if what you do or what you have to offer or what you've discovered or invented or innovated, if that offering you have that could be of service to people, either within your industry or in the world at large, if that does not fit in with the pre-existing marketing and distribution apparatus of that industry, that it is being suppressed or repressed. And this gets back to this idea of business as usual. It's not personal. It's just that, indeed, it does not fit into the pre-existing marketing and distribution apparatus. So you are best off going outside that pre-existing apparatus. And in traveling the world, making the truth is out there, we met so many people who either through their ingenuity or through their brilliance or through just the sweat of their labor or sometimes through just freak accident have discovered, developed, invented, innovated, remembered simple solutions in many cases to complex problems that affect people. And these things are not able to serve or be of use to a great number of people because, quite simply, nobody knows about them, but they're out there. And so this is why truth is out there, business as usual, and hopefully if our dreams come true, we can actually turn that one into a series where each week we are showing different possibilities to people that exist to help them in a wide range of complex situations, from technology to food to health, what have you. Because it is, you know, if we look to nature, nature is replete with answers to our questions. If we look within to our own nature within us is replete with possible answers. You know, there is not one way to do something right. There are many ways to do something right. And we know that when we think creatively, but when we think like a corporation, when we think with a bottom line, then we get stuck in this box of how something needs to be done to support that bottom line. One of my favorite quotes in any movie is from the classic Citizen Kane, where the character of Charles Foster Kane, patterned after, or no, it wasn't, it was his business manager, actually says, there's no trick to making a lot of money if all you want is to make a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
What is tricky is if you want something more than that, if you want to be of service, if you want to have rich, meaningful relationships and connect as deeply as possible with what it means to be human, then you know what? The corporate rules and the way of doing business as usual don't help with any of that.
You know, I think, you know, what so many things are born out of right now is that when people have vision and they're stuck in that box, which can be very oppressive. I mean, we have arcane business models that do not at all reflect where many of us feel society is going. You know, there is no, not only is creativity stifled, but collaboration. And see, that's where I was really getting at and what I was trying to do at the time is where can we establish these collaborative business models? And you can actually see how it would not only improve the bottom line, it would make a quantum leap in the bottom line. That's the irony of it, is the people who see this, who see these new ways of doing things, deep down, they know that it's not contrary to the bottom line at all. It's just that there's a certain fear that is in operation. I mean, we get back to fear again in the corporate culture where anything different, like you say, anything outside the box, that's going to impact the bottom line because it's risky. You know, it may have some risk. And yet, that isn't necessarily the case. The way that you actually jump in terms of, you know, I like to use the term abundance instead of profit because to me profit sounds tawdry anymore to me. You know, I just don't like any of that anymore. If you want to get into a place of mutual abundance, and can you imagine a situation where there's actually collaboration within an organization instead of top-down ancient authoritarian structures where people are disempowered? I mean, and we know disempowerment doesn't work anymore. It's not going to work within the new models that I think the world is establishing. I really feel that.
You know, with a slightly different spelling, of course, it is a prophet that brings us word of the God we worship, right? And we've simply changed the spelling, and it's prophet that brings us of the almighty dollar that we worship. And we lose sight of the fact that our currency is just colored paper. It's not backed by anything except an idea that it is of value. And I love the word currency because currency is a word that we use with energy, and it reminds us that currency is simply energy. And
yes.
We give all our energy towards this colored paper. And a new currency is emerging. And
yes.
I have heard this from people studying the Mayan calendar. I have heard this from Tibetan masters. I have heard this from the heads of Swiss banks, that a new currency is emerging, one that is based on admiration.
Wow.
That of entire societies, of entire communities, putting their energy towards that which they admire. That investment is based on admiration, not a quote-unquote profit motive. If,
mm-hmm.
for example, you would never, ever want a super Walmart in your neighborhood, why are you investing in the Walmart Corporation?
Exactly.
Invest your energy, be it your money, which is energy, be it your time, be it your love, your care, all your resources, the abundance of your resources, invest those in people, ideas, concepts, undertakings that you admire, and see what grows then. Because then you go from being a worker bee to being a gardener of consciousness.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Because, you know, sometimes you're not even really a worker bee anymore. In some situations, I mean, you're like a slave, although you don't really see it, you know, if you can't, and we can't really be productive in that situation. But if we could be gardeners, you know, it doesn't mean, there can be different levels of contribution, and that's normal within a society. And we can honor each other for every contribution
Absolutely.
That we make.
No two gardens are supposed to look alike. If we could realize that, if we could realize truly that we are gardeners, then it would no longer be about proving anything. It would be about tending as conscientiously to the garden we're growing as possible, and it wouldn't be about leaning over into the neighbor's yard and telling him how to grow his garden.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that we're getting close. We've got about 13 minutes left. I wanted to give you the opportunity to talk about the creation of Hieroglyph of the Human Soul, where you're working on this documentary about Lee McCloskey. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I know that's a garden that you're tending at the moment. So I wanted to give you that chance to discuss that a little bit.
Well, many of these topics we've talked about on this show are topics that I have spoken of with Lee at great length. And in fact, if people want to obviously learn about Lee, they can go to our Kickstarter page, Hieroglyph of the Human Soul, for a documentary we're making about this man, his art, and his philosophy. They can also go to my podcast, chillpackhollywood.com, chillpackhollywood.com, and listen to episode 269, I believe it was, which was an hour-long conversation with him, and it's really deeply inspiring. He is this amazing man, truly a Renaissance man.
Yeah.
An actor and an artist and a philosopher and an author and a painter, and he had done many masterworks of art leading up to 2001. But in 2001, he began to paint his studio, and it became a living painting that is called The Hieroglyph of the Human Soul. He painted everything in that study, in that library, the floor, the linoleum on the floor, the couch, the walls, the ceilings, the back of books. And what emerged, which was entirely an intuitive process, was the very long and arduous mythological journey that our species has taken to achieve consciousness. And it also, he discovered years later, is holographic. If you walk through the room with 3D glasses on, you are actually wading through the waters of ancient mystery and infinite creation, and these mythological archetypes are coming up towards you through these waters. So
yes.
It's this profound work. But what is great about it is, as deep as the work is, his philosophy is so human and humane and easily approachable. It's really, to me, a very important undertaking to document conversations and interviews with great thinkers. Because,
yeah.
you know, we've had so many great thinkers throughout human history, and what is always astonishing to me is how two people can express the exact same wisdom from the exact same source, but if they are embodying different energies while expressing it, the meaning totally changes.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really a wonderful, wonderfully unique opportunity we have as humans right here, right now, on planet Earth with all the technology available to us, to preserve who these thinkers really are and to be able to remember and preserve for our offspring the realization that these are human beings. These were not people who were beyond us. They were not better than
yes.
us. They were us. And they were simply writing letters in a bottle. The great
yeah.
philosophers, that's what they were doing. They were writing letters in a bottle that told about why they loved being human, why they loved their wives, why they loved their families, why they loved their friends, what it was that made the often arduous battle of being human worthwhile. And they were putting those letters in a bottle for us to find. And the great philosophers were the ones who found the right tone. That's what it was. More than their wisdom, it's the tone. Because as storytellers, we learn this. If you find the right tone, then you might not get the huge opening weekend box office, but you will have created something that will ambiate across the ages. For
yes.
example, I made a film, an independent film called Karl Rove, I Love You, a very weird,
right.
a very weird love letter to what has been called one of the most evil political figures of our time. And it's very much a comedy. It's a fictional documentary, a comedy that really makes fun of the whole modern era of political disagreement where people on either sides of an issue can't have civil conversation with each other. And we lampoon very much that. And we finished it in 2007. Here it is, 2012, 5 years later, and the film is about to be released in Europe. And in some respects, I would think, oh, well, that's too bad that it took 5 years. But on the other hand, I'm really pleased that the tone of the film still resonates, and in fact probably resonates even more 5 years later. And so tone is so important. And getting
yes.
back to my project, Hieroglyph of the Human Soul, we could just shoot pictures. We could create 3D representations and distribute them in a variety of means of Lee's artwork. But getting to combine them with conversations where we capture his really unique and enchanting and loving tone is, I think, so important. And one of the reasons it's important is that Lee fundamentally is someone whose work is all about giving each of us permission to explore the great multiplicity within all of us. We are all of us many things. We are all
mm-hmm.
of us Renaissance people. And we've been told so often in our lives, oh, you need to focus on this. Oh, you're a writer, you're a director, you're an editor, you're a producer. But if you had to only choose one, what would it be? You know, this kind of thinking that tries to encourage us to identify with one thing. I am a
yes.
filmmaker, or I am a lover, or I am a public servant, or I am a, you know, instead of I am a human being, and as a human being, I am exploring the rich panoply of roles that are available to me, because in doing so, I will learn more about myself. And his work at its heart gives us permission and inspires us to do that. So I it's quite an honor to be donating my time, my skill, my equipment to making this film about him, and we are seeking crowdsourcing support to help us with things like the sound mix and the mastering and the replication and the packaging of the film itself.
And there is a link on both the show page, not to sound like a telethon here or anything, but just for people who are interested, there is a link on the show page as well as on frontierbeyondfear.com if
well,
people want to go
yeah.
over there. Because it is a very, you know, I hadn't really thought about it from the perspective of Phil. You have such a perspective perspective of preserving these people, these concepts that people like Lee are expressing for the future. I never quite grasp. I love seeing that as a glimpse into your work, the legacy. Legacy is important.
It's hard to keep our eyes on that when all around us we have reasons to believe that the sky is falling and we're so overcome. The best of us in how do we fix what's wrong all around us right now. It's important, though, to realize at the very least our responsibility is to perhaps shine light for the future. We might not be able to solve problems right now, but if we can at least keep certain conversations, certain questions, certain dreams about what it means to be human alive, well, then we'll have played our part artfully. And that's what I realized. I say to people a great deal, I tell this story, that when I was traveling with Karl Rove, I Love You, I realized I'd been lying to myself most of my life. I used to always believe that I traveled around showing my films, pitching my films, promoting my films, so that hopefully I would be allowed to keep making films. And what I realized was that, in fact, I make movies so that I will be allowed to travel around and meet people and learn from them and learn about myself. The making movies is my way of singing for my supper, and if I sing artfully, then I can be happy that I've been of value to people. And part of that value is to shine a light forward, obviously. In terms of this telethon issue, of course, I hope people will visit the Kickstarter page and give generously. Truly,
yeah,
though, I think too many people who use Kickstarter lose sight, though, of the other real value of it, which is you're already getting the message out there. I'm already allowing people who never knew of Lee and his work to discover his work simply by visiting the Kickstarter page, simply by coming on and doing interviews like this. Why I want to make the film is for people to discover his work. Well, I can already help people discover his work regardless of whether or not that crowdsource funding comes together. So I encourage everyone to visit it and to pass the link along, because we did cut together a beautiful trailer, and it does introduce
nice
you to his ideas. And so.
And you know, I was trying to say, and we only have 3 minutes left here, and actually one thing I'm going to do, because I know that people can listen to you in the Chill Pack Hour as well. If you're enjoying Phil, make sure that you catch him in the Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, and I'm going to play a little bit of that at the end, which may actually end up in the archive version of the show if we run out of time. But I wanted to say, and we do have a lot of archive listeners, just so you know, and I actually welcome those people because their energy is with us, those who are listening in the future. But I wanted to say, as far as the telethon thing, it's that there is a true sincerity here, and I'm glad that you got at that, because that's what I mean. I was trying to say that, you know, we are truly sincere about revealing very powerful truths in the world, and you know, and that's what's so important about what you're trying to do here. And so, you know, now that we only have a couple minutes left, I want to thank you, Phil. I mean, you are truly an inspiration and a joy to know. I really have appreciated the depth of what you have to share and what you're doing in the world. And I think that your own legacy is continually being revealed here, and it's really going to be exciting to see where you take all of this. That's how I see it from my perspective.
More will be revealed. Thanks for having me on the show, Susan. I'm sorry we didn't get around to discussing what we touched upon in our emails earlier today. So next time, I guess.
I told you, this show flies by, and you know, it's a really enjoyable time. I mean, I love connecting with people here, and again, I want to encourage people, if you want to learn more about Phil, all of his links are on the show page, so you can pretty much click on anything And you can always write to the show at info@frontierbeyondfear.com. And also, tell us where they can reach you. If someone wants to send you an email, Phil, what's the best way to contact you? Or through your website, or is there a way?
No, what we always tell people on our show is to contact us at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com, chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com, just like the name of the show, but without the hour at the end. And Dean and I read every email that we get there. You know, with Facebook and Twitter and all of these, there's so many ways to reach out to people, and sometimes those messages, although we read them, slip through the cracks. But at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com, we always know that there's something in there that we need to answer or address. And so that's how I encourage people to do it.
Okay, well, thank you so much for being here today, and I look forward to talking to you in the future. And thanks to our audience, too, for being here.
And now play the promo you teased us with at the beginning.
Well, see, now we're in overtime. See,
right.
That's the secret of this show, and I will play it now. So,
okay.
Thank you so much, Phil.
Goodbye, Susan.
All right.
And now, hi, I am Dean Haglund here in the offices of Rational Exuberance with your co-host and mine, Mr. Phil Lernes, ladies and gentlemen.
I have almost as many nicknames. Nuffy Enough, Ocho Cinco.
Cinco.
Sulu from TV Star Trek.
Sheriff.
Sheriff
from MySpace.
The Doctor. Almost as many nicknames as Kim Jong-il.
Celebrity deaths.
When it comes to death, we give death the weight that it deserves. How does the world change without Kim Jong-il?
Explanation of the week.
I imagine that very rare collection of DVDs goes on sale on eBay.
Lawsuit of the week.
We are high as a kite on eggnog.
Wingnut of the week.
They were marginalized by their societies because of their crazy views, which, oh, by the way, turned out to be right.
Right, exactly.
Your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lernes.
It's especially enjoyed at chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, hollywood.com.
Belated spoiler alert.
Of course, one of the big stars on The X-Files, and he's making a documentary called The Truth Is Out There.
One of the things that UFO research has done to me is instill in me a healthy disrespect for the things that government says.
They are poisoning our people. There is a population control agenda. There really are people who want to kill off the majority of the people in the world.
If we don't allow these corrupt banks to fail, then the nation will fail, and there will be no recovery.
Don't stand on the sides of the river and comment on how corrupt and dark and evil everything is. We all know that.
I don't need to have you understand or agree with me or believe. It doesn't matter to me. I know what I know.
The name of our film is?
The truth is out there.
But it really isn't.
But isn't there a universal truth that science is going for?
Perhaps the universal truth is what makes us subjective.
Okay, you just blew my mind.